Well, I was counting on 40 to 45 minutes, so fasten your seat belts and pray that the technology will work. All right. I did not choose the title that's in the bulletin, but we'll make it work. So hang on. If they let me finish, it'll work. All right, Revelation 12:17 text to begin with. The dragon was angry with the woman, went away to make war with the remnant of her seed. What is that remnant becomes the question. The traditional Adventist answer is essentially the remnant is baptized members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But that particular perspective is harder and harder to defend in today's world. In particular, many Adventists are struggling with that concept and saying, you know, it's got to be something more. At the same time, it's increasingly a barrier in the secular community, where once testing truths were things like Sabbath, state of the dead, tithing. For a postmodern generation, the most serious challenge seems to be the remnant. That's the point where the typical postmodern person says, you know, that's arrogant. That's and even a large percentage of our own seminary students feel that very, very strongly. Many of our evangelists feeling it very strongly, not only in North America, but in other parts of the world. So, let's start with the identity of the remnant as of the book of Revelation, and like I said, keep those seatbelts fastened, tray tables in upright and locked position. It's going to go fast. The end of earth history. All right, Revelation 12, if you study that with care, you'll see that the remnant come right at the end of the era, the Christian era. Revelation 10, and again, we could spend an hour probably on each of these easily. At the close of Daniel's time prophecies, Revelation indicates between the close of Daniel's time prophecies and the second coming will be a period that Daniel calls the time of the end. And in that period, there will be a remnant, and they will teach certain things, according to the book of Revelation. They will possess a prophetic visionary gift. Some of you may not buy that. If you gave me an hour or two, I think I could make the case. So I would stand with that. It is also the object of worldwide attention and has a message of worldwide significance. In other words, everybody's talking about it. It's the focus. In those last two senses, of course, the Adventist institution probably falls a bit short of fully attaining that concept. In terms of the message of the remnant, again, moving quickly, the gospel will be an important component, and we'll have a text or two for each of these. Daniel and Revelation, according to Revelation 10, both of those will be significant in the final crisis. The author has said, you must prophesy again, and then it goes on to talk about those later eras of the remnant and so forth. The sanctuary, especially the heavenly sanctuary, will be a part of that message. Keeping all God's commandments becomes a core issue. Warning of end time deception, Revelation 13. A relationship with Jesus, Revelation 14. The hour of judgment. And finally, the Sabbath. And I've argued that in several articles in a number of places, including Jeff's. It's kind of a summary of the message of the remnant. They're just taking an exegetical perspective, just letting the text take us where it goes. It identifies in the final era of Earth's history a remnant that will teach these things and have certain identity characteristics. Having said that, let's go back into the Old Testament and look at the concept of remnant in the Old Testament, because I think something very important can be found there that will make a huge difference. First of all, going back to the beginning of the Bible, back to Genesis, the covenant with Abraham was a universal and everlasting covenant. And the purpose of that covenant was to bless all nations. So through Abraham, every nation on earth was to be blessed. Israel, Abraham's seed, was to be a kingdom of priests. In other words, it functioned like Levi to the entire world. So the purpose of Israel, the purpose of Abraham, was to bless the world and in a real sense restore the Garden of Eden. Again, that would need to be argued. I've done that in other places. But this is a summary looking at the big picture. And that's probably why you're here. Because the big picture is what really counts. All right. So Israel's call was call for the nations. It was a call to all the nations to come into relationship with God. Clearly, that was not fulfilled when Joshua brought them into the promised land. It was only a down payment. The full intention of God was not met at the conclusion of the Exodus. And so the rest of Old Testament history is basically a failure to obtain the promise that was made to Abraham. You think of the judges and some of the horrible things going on there. Solomon, his apostasy, Jeroboam, Ahab, Manasseh, captivity, occupation. You have to, I think, see that this is really a history of failure, a history of disgrace. It does not come close to achieving what God intended. So, how does God respond? And what God does, I believe, is respond with the remnant concept. Now, I'm going to lean here very heavily on the work of Gerhard Hassel, who is one of my teachers, a former dean of the seminary, and probably the world's most respected scholar on the concept of remnant. And Hassel worked exclusively with the Old Testament, and what I want to do today is expand his work beyond the Old Testament, taking courage from Angel Rodriguez and several others who have been exploring the same ideas, whether or not I've understood them correctly. But I think we're all moving in the same general direction, that there's got to be some bigger implication than just what happened in the Old Testament. So basically, in the Old Testament, God is responding to that failed history with a threefold remnant concept. First, the historical remnant. And for me, the historical remnant is remnant in the past tense. Whenever you're thinking of remnant in the Old Testament, in the past tense, it's a historical remnant, a remnant you can look back and identify that God at some point intervened. They survived a disaster that was physical or spiritual, whatever. And for example, Noah from the flood is called a remnant. Abraham from the 70 nations, not called a remnant specifically, but the total package there indicates him to be a remnant character. Israel from Egyptian slavery is a historical remnant. Israel from conquest by Assyria, a historical remnant. So as the prophets look back, as Moses looks back, he identifies remnants in the past. Those are usually clearly identifiable marks of God's activity in the past. An example of that is found here in 2 Chronicles 30, verse 6. O people of Israel, return to the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you that have escaped from the hand of the kings of Assyria. So it's past tense. They were a remnant who in the past escaped. Now, are they faithful remnant? According to the text. No. Because God's calling them, calling the remnant to return to him. So this is not a faithful remnant. Historical remnant can be faithful or unfaithful or a mixture, and usually they're a mixture of some sort. So historical remnant doesn't have to be perfect. All right. Second concept of remnant in Hassel's understanding, which from my perspective is a present tense understanding, and that is faithful remnant. The faithful remnant is from that historical remnant. Right, historical remnant moves through history. In the present tense, linked to that historical remnant are some faithful people. These faithful people are of that historical remnant. They have the identity. They've grasped the mission. They're on track of God's intention for that historical remnant. But there may be a few out of the whole. There are some that are faithful, many are unfaithful, and some call this an invisible remnant simply because none of us really knows who in this congregation is faithful and who is not. We may make some assumptions, but only God knows. And to that extent, some might call it invisible. Example, 1 Kings. Elijah said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I alone, am left. And they seek my life to take it away." God says, "Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him." To Elijah, 6,999 were invisible, you see. It was a faithful remnant, one that God knew, one that God could detect within the historical remnant of Israel. So a faithful remnant concept. Third aspect of remnant. Well, before we get to that, I have, in carefully studying over the last couple months, seen that faithful remnant is not always present tense. It is sometimes future tense. Take a look at this. Isaiah 10. "In that day, the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean on him who struck them, but will lean on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people be Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return." And that remnant, survivors, will lean on the Lord. You see that? So this is a faithful remnant in the future. It's a prediction that out of many who return, most of whom will be destroyed, some will be faithful. So there's a future faithful remnant. In that day, you see, there'll be a remnant. So the faithful remnant concept that we usually think of as present tense can also be in the future. And that brings us to the eschatological remnant, the purely future tense. And this eschatological remnant is special because it breaks the boundaries of the historical remnant. Whereas up until now, there's all been a straight thread, historical to present faithful to future faithful. That's all a line, you see, a straight line. But when you get into the future, something happens. And Isaiah 66 describes it powerfully. "I will set a sign among them, and from them I will send survivors to the nations," that's the remnant, "that have not heard my fame nor seen my glory." So what nations? Those who aren't part of the historical remnant. They've never heard of God. They don't know anything about the Exodus and all the mighty things He has done. "They shall declare," who? The remnant, that future faithful remnant. "They shall declare my glory among the nations, and they shall bring all your brothers from all the nations as an offering to the Lord to my holy mountain Jerusalem." That future faithful remnant will have a mission. And there are several shocking texts in the Old Testament that describe a massive return. You know, 10 people grabbing the skirt of one Jew. Zechariah chapter 8, for example. It's going to be a massive development that is shocking and surprising among the nations. Big. Unpredictable. The eschatological remnants of the Old Testament are bigger than Israel. They're unpredictable. They're international. When they come, they're stunning. They're surprising. Take a look at this shocking text, Isaiah 19. "In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will go to Egypt and the Egyptians to Assyria. The Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together." Worship who? "In that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth." In other words, the promise to Abraham is now expanded to the enemies of Israel. The blessing has grown. "The Lord Almighty will bless them, saying, 'Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance.'" Now that is absolutely stunning, but I think the clear implication is that eschatological remnants in the Old Testament are bigger, more international, more unpredictable than perhaps even Isaiah might have grasped. Let's summarize. Historical remnant from the Old Testament prophets. Historical remnant is the Israel of the Exodus. Faithful remnant would be those faithful in Babylon during the time of the prophets or just before and after. The faithful remnant. Eschatological remnant, ultimately is the return developing into the church. Now I ask you the question, could Isaiah have fully grasped the church? That's how it would all be fulfilled? It seems to me that the church transcends the boundaries even of the Old Testament prophetic proclamation. In other words, the eschatological remnant will be a surprise. It'll be bigger, more international, unpredictable to some degree. And all the Old Testament eschatological remnants carry some of that weight. Moving to the New Testament, now here's where some of us have broken beyond Hazel's research, taken it and said, can it apply to the New Testament? And my answer would be unqualified yes. Look at Romans chapter 11. I ask then, has God rejected His people? What people? Historical remnant. Old Testament Israel. By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected His people whom He foreknew. Do you not know what the Scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets, demolished your altars, I alone am left, and they seek my life. Remember that text? But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So too, at the present time, there's a remnant chosen by grace. So Paul picks up on the Old Testament theme, applies it explicitly to who? From Paul's perspective, historical remnant, Old Testament Israel. Faithful remnant, the followers of Jesus. Within the historical remnant, there was a faithful remnant that followed the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. Eschatological remnant, the end time church. Now, do you think Paul would be boggled just a little to discover that there's 2 billion Christians in the world? From every nation, tribe, Paul, I think, had an expansive vision of the future, but you have to see, if you try to look through Paul's eyes and see the church of today, in its variety, in its huge size, in its impact on history and on culture, Paul would have thought, wow, and I thought we'd done it all in my lifetime. Unbelievable. Bigger, more international, unpredictable. Moving quickly, keep your seatbelts fastened, the light is still on. Revelation 12:17 speaks of the eschatological remnant. And what I'd like to suggest, that we apply the template of three remnants to the remnant today, to our time and our point in time. The remnant of Revelation. It's a great end time remnant. They follow God's revelations. They hold the faith of Jesus. But it will be bigger, more international, perhaps even more unpredictable than we can imagine today. Revelation 14:6, to every nation, tribe, language, and people, and the question of the evening, religion? Is there a place for Islam in the remnant? The remnant of Revelation, applying the template, historical remnant, would be historic Adventism. Millerite movement, 1844, the development of our pioneers. I see no other way of successfully reading Revelation. Some of you may disagree, but I have put a few years into it. And I believe that the best identification is clearly historic Adventism. Faithful remnant then, today, would be the bearers of identity from that historical remnant. So, Angel, I wouldn't think that a Lutheran or Catholic would be part of that faithful remnant today, because there's got to be a link to the story, based on at least the practices of the past. There would be a link to the historical remnant. The others may well be Christians, part of Paul's eschatological remnant. That's not questioning that at all. But there's a special mission, special message, special role for the end of time. Eschatological remnant? Well, that's still ahead. And history would tell me, bigger, more international, more unpredictable than maybe even we have yet grasped. In order to understand this and put the role of Islam into perspective, we need to do a short history of Christianity. And since we're about 17 minutes in, it'll be about a 3-minute history. But one of the problems our evangelists face is that most of the historians we depend on have now been discredited by historians. And that's a problem. Okay, we realize that if all scientists discredit our view of creation, we have a problem. If all historians discredit our view of history, we have a problem. But I have good news for you today. Some of the finest historians in the world are now talking Adventist language. And when you've seen what they have said, this is work of the last 10 years or so, I find it absolutely breathtaking. The bottom line for today's historians is that Christianity emerged from Judaism. It was not a unique faith back at the beginning. There was one God. The same scripture, the same temple, one people. I think this has been overlooked by perhaps Germanic historians, you know, who like to think of Europe as the measure of all things. The reality is Christianity started as an Eastern religion, a Middle Eastern religion, and a Jewish sect, a Jewish religion. James Dunn, one of the world's leading scholars of both Paul and early Christian history, wrote a fascinating book, The Partings of the Ways. And in that book, he describes how those four unities broke apart between Judaism and Christianity. It began already in the first century. And the decisive period was from about 70 to 135. So very, very early, Christianity broke from Judaism. And what happened? My colleague Richard here has inspired me on some of this. What happened is almost when two religions split, it's almost like they're doing horse trading. It's like they're saying, oh, you're all excited about the Messiah. Well, we'll let you have that. We'll take the law. You know, oh, you're all excited about eschatology. Well, you keep that. We'll take the Sabbath. Okay, you keep the Sabbath. We'll have Jesus. You know, and so they kind of horse trade and both sides lose. Both sides lose when you take that hostility toward each other. Bart Ehrman, I think without peer today as early church historian and textual critic, is widely respected and is not a professing Christian. His research assistant was a Seventh-day Adventist when he wrote this book, but he claims to have had no influence over this book. Amazing book called Lost Christianities. And Ehrman powerfully argues what some before him have hinted at, such as Pelikan and Bauer, that there were five or six versions of Christianity in the first centuries. In other words, the New Testament was broad-based enough that people do what people do. Most people do a canon within the canon, naturally. You know, they pick out the parts of the Bible that they want to get excited about, and they ignore the parts that don't fit their personality and so on. And that happens in our day as well. Well, it happened apparently in the first couple centuries. And one of these five or six became what we call Orthodox Christianity. And that is basically the Christianity of Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox Christians, and Seventh-day Adventists. Those were all from that Orthodox tradition. But a different branch of early Christianity was accepted by Jesus' family. There's an interesting one. Jesus' own family didn't feel at home in the Orthodox branch of Christianity. Now, something's going on there, says Ehrman. And basically, I'm summarizing Ehrman in the next several slides. Most of these five or six versions can be traced. They have a root in the New Testament, even if it's poor reading or it's mixed with error or whatever you want to say. They have roots in the New Testament. But all but the Orthodox were suppressed by the 4th century, and guess who Ehrman names as a key figure? Constantine. So you see, the historians are beginning to come back. And I think this is tremendously helpful to us. Jewish Christianity did not survive. Though accepted by Jesus' family, they kept the Sabbath. They emphasized obedience. They emphasized the importance of the Old Testament for Christian faith. Sound familiar? And Ehrman laments. There were consequences. when Christianity cut itself off from some of the voices within Christianity, there were consequences. While Ehrman himself does not profess Christianity, he says Christianity is not what it could have been. Sounds almost like an Adventist perspective, doesn't it? The parting of the ways with Judaism, the hardening between Jews and Christians, caused losses both ways. And it precipitated Islam, one of the least known things. I mean, today you read Christian literature on Islam and it is so hateful and so full of things. It's just unvarnished paganism and some really, really awful things are said. I don't know that they've ever seriously read and seriously tried to understand. Islam, when it arose, Muhammad's original dream, I believe, was to reunite Judaism and Christianity in one faith, to make it Eastern again, to undo the damage that the Orthodox had brought in, Orthodox that we have come to call the apostasy, the papacy, and so forth. Remember, Muhammad is after 538 in the period that we call the time of apostasy. A few quotations from the Quran. The early surahs of Muhammad are amazing. Say ye, we believe in Allah and the revelation given to us and to Ibrahim, Ismail, Isaac, Jacob, and the descendants of Jacob, and that given to Moses and Jesus, and that given to all the prophets from their Lord. We make no difference between one and another of them, and we bow to Allah. In other words, the prophets of Judaism and Christianity would be treated equally. He did not claim to be above them, even though Islam later took that position. Look at this one. Those who deny Allah and His messengers, those who wish to separate Allah from His messengers, saying, we believe in some but reject others, they are in truth unbelievers. In other words, those like Christians and Jews who isolate each other, that hardening, he's condemning that and saying, no, you've lost something. You've given up some of God's revelation to emphasize others. No, you must treat it all the same. To those who believe in Allah and His messengers, make no distinction between any of them. We shall soon give their due rewards, for Allah is merciful and forgiving. The early Muhammad was trying to restore what was lost. The scriptures of Judaism and Christianity are normative for the Muslim. It is Allah who sent down to thee step by step in truth the book, confirming what went before it. What went before it? To Muhammad, the book was Old Testament, New Testament, and Quran, the revelation that he was receiving, or he perceived to be receiving. In other words, he felt that what he was getting was confirming the other, not disconfirming. Eunice, by the way, is Jonah. There are lots of biblical stories in the Quran. If thou wert in doubt as to what we have revealed unto thee, then ask those who have been reading the book from before thee. The truth hath indeed come to thee from thy Lord, so be in no wise of those who doubt. If you have doubts about Muhammad, go consult the Jews and the Christians. They have the book. That's all that you need. Judaism and Christianity are even valid expressions of Islam. There was to be no forced conversion. Say to the people of the book, that's Jews and Christians, and to those who are unlearned, do ye not also submit yourselves? In other words, why don't you become Muslims? He's making an evangelistic appeal to join him. And then he says, if they do, they are in right guidance. But if they turn back, thy duty is to convey the message, and in Allah's sight are all His servants. In other words, if they say no, let them go. They're serving God too. You see? So Muhammad had, in the early period, had this vision of a restoration of that which was lost in the parting of the ways. Of course, in the end, the parting became a threefold parting. And the tragic Yathrib battle, it's the city we call Medina today, when the Jews joined up with the pagans to attempt to prevent the Muslims from controlling all of Arabia. And at that point, something seems to have changed, and Muhammad hardened against the Jews and the Christians, and they hardened against him. And again, there were losses. And so Ehrman summarizes and says, that another loss was narrow and selective reading of the New Testament. Would you say that's an accurate assessment? Narrow and selective reading is more common than uncommon among Christians. And finally, a general ignorance of the Old Testament. Now, this is a secular scholar, a secular historian talking. It's amazing history. And in the end, you have Christianity, Judaism, and Islam all hardening into what I would call core values. And these are beautiful values. Gospel, grace, Jesus, law, obedience, Sabbath, submission, judgment, eschatology. These are great values. But each of them has lost by denying what the others have. How are we going to get back? Philip Jenkins in The Next Christendom, a powerful book that you ought to read, talks of the geographical movement of Christendom. Started in the Middle East, migrated to Europe, now has basically centered itself in North America. But he's noting that Christianity is moving back south and east. It's going back to its roots. It's becoming more Eastern. The Christianity of Africa, the Christianity of Asia is very different from that of Europe. And it's going to get more and more different, he points out. Solution? How are you going to get them all together? You're not going to believe this. Jenkins, not an Adventist, says, Book of Revelation, that's the place everyone will find their home. Which brings me back to the remnant of Revelation and the teachings there. Gospel, Daniel and Revelation, sanctuary, keeping all the commandments, warning of end time deception, relationship with Jesus, hour of judgment, Sabbath. Are you seeing what I'm seeing? God has designed the remnant as the middle player that can bring all these together. If we have a problem with any of these core values, which would be the biggest problem? It would be Christianity, wouldn't it? We struggle with grace. We struggle with how to handle gospel. We're pretty strong on submission, judgment, law, Sabbath, and so forth. Role of Islam, and this is new at this point. This was not in the paper. 2 a.m, so this may be crazy. All right. But basically, if you go to the Middle East and ask a Muslim the defining marks that separate a Muslim from Christianity, alcohol, Christians drink, Muslims don't. Pork, Christians eat. In fact, to prove you've converted from Islam to Christianity, you've got to eat pork. Modesty, Christianity to a Muslim is Hollywood and Playboy magazine. The view of the papacy, Christians favorable, Muslims not. View of America, Christians favorable, Muslims not. And finally, submission, obedience. When they look at Hollywood, they don't see Christians living out their scriptures or their faith. On which side of the divide do Adventists fall? You see my point? You see? And I have found from experience that when you present the Adventist message not as a Christian message, now this may sound like heresy in North America, but look at it from the Middle Eastern perspective. When you present it not as a Christian message, but as a unique end-time spiritual movement led by God, Muslims don't have the problems that they seem to have so widely with Christian mission. I've seen them embracing Jesus, embracing the Sabbath, embracing the messages of the 28 fundamentals. Amazing. The openness and the excitement over these things. It seems like almost a natural fit. I'm closing. And so, I cast a vision. Is it possible that the remnant itself is not yet ready to grasp the expansive eschatological remnant vision that seems so consistent throughout Scripture? To be an Adventist, to be the bearer of a vital and unique message, Philip Jenkins is almost persuaded to say it's the only message that can possibly bring these three faiths together. And he and I are going to be speaking together at a conference in Ohio later this year. I can't wait to go deeply into some of these things because I've discovered them in part through his contribution. There's no guarantee for us. It's not arrogance. It's not pride. There's no guarantee that we're going to make it. It's a message. It's a role. It's a mission. We can grab it or not. We can be faithful or not. That's not a basis for arrogance. It's a calling and a gift from God, not a reason to boast. So what's God's solution at the end of time? Historical remnant, a pain in the neck. Historical remnant, kind of a hard place to find Jesus. I mean, wherever I go, people are challenged by the dark side of Adventism. But where else are you going to go? The only place you can prepare for the eschatological remnant to become part of the historical remnant. What else is it? Where else are you going to learn? Where else are you going to grow? Where else can you be faithful to the mission? If there's another place, let me know. But there is a place where that role, that mission is still being proclaimed. Maybe not by as many as we would like. But join that historical remnant and then fasten your seatbelts, put the tray tables in upright and locked position. Even go into brace position. This is going to be a shaky takeoff in sheer winds. God has got surprises up His sleeve. The three angels' message of the Old Testament, the climactic gospel message, is this. And I will close with this. I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. The climactic message of Old Testament Israel is a message of reconciliation, a message of come home, the message of the eschatological remnant.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.